This is Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, and all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net.
911, what are you reporting?
We got someone or something crawling around out here.
Did you see what it was? Was it a person or an animal? Or
I can't tell. All I know is that my sensor light came on, and I just happened to glimpse and see this thing running across the yard. A good-sized man, or something looks like a man. I don't know what it was, just that it ran across the yard. Whatever it is, it's running. I couldn't catch it if I was going to chase it. Jesus Christ, you better... Tia!
Hello?
Get somebody out here.
What's going on now, sir?
That son of a bitch is about 6'9", I don't know.
Do you see him now, sir?
Yes, I'm looking right at him.
Is he in your yard, sir?
Yeah, God, he's big.
Okay, what's he doing in your yard?
He's looking at me.
Oh, and the guy is on foot?
It's a big, real big person, that's all I can say.
Okay, but it is a person.
Yeah, I'd say it was a person or somebody really big, but he's all in black.
Is he a black male or a white male? Did you actually see whether, or was he just wearing black?
He's all black and he's big. He is big.
Strange Harbor, ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. This is Strange Harbor.
And another exciting episode of Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird,
the strange, the unbelievable, the unsubstantiated, and the unleavened.
The unleavened?
The unleavened, yes.
What's that mean?
I don't know.
Johnny and Billy here. It's another edition of Strange Harbor. Our guest returns of the Olympic Project, one of the core members, Mr. David Ellis.
How you doing, David?
I'm doing great today. How
Wonderful.
About you guys?
We haven't spoke to you in a while on the show. We've seen you at the Sasquatch Summit and the conferences that you participate in. And how are things been?
Oh, they've been great. I'm getting vocalizations from all across the country. People are sending me stuff. And the fun part about it is they want me to look at some specific, and I usually find something else within the audio that piqued my interest more than what they're pointing to, and that's because I look at the sounds visually. So I take my cues by visual voice prints or visual things that I'm looking for rather than just listening to the audio.
So the visuals, they don't lie, or do they?
Well, you as an observer may make a incorrect assessment of looking out the sound, but they're pretty much like a voice print,
mm-hmm.
And if you know what you're looking for and resonating in the what I call the sweet spot, which is between 550 hertz and 750 hertz, things resonating in that area have my attention because it's a little lower range than what a coyote or other known vocalizations reside in. So, yes, I look for specific cues. And one of the things that I'm discovering, too, that I hadn't really kind of put together, it's something I call a percussive voice. It has a voice structure, but it's clicks and pops. And I believe this is my assessment, the path that I'm kind of going down, but I believe that is part of their repertoire for vocalization. Maybe tongue clicking or hand clapping or other things of that nature. But it has a percussive tone to it.
We have civilizations that have those, right?
Yeah, that's what's interesting. There are cultures that use the tongue clicks and pops within their language. So it's not an uncommon thing among humans. Well, it's rare, but it's not. I guess it is uncommon. It is rare, but it is something that is in different cultures. So maybe there's a basis for it.
Has anybody taken any alleged Sasquatch clicking and compared it to human clicking language and tried to find any similarities?
No, but that would be a good good little homework project. Maybe you and I can get on that.
Yeah, that might be fun.
Well, and those types of languages where they use clicks and tongue clicks and different tones are often much older cultures, like the Aborigines of Australia.
Yeah.
So it would make sense that Bigfoot might have a more ancient language than what we're familiar with.
I think you're onto something, Billy.
Wow. Right here on Strange Harbor.
Yeah, right here. We broke it right here on Strange Harbor.
Move over, Scott Nelson.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I think Johnny and I had talked about this once before. I don't know if we talked about it on the air. About the... because we were listening to some Bigfoot sounds, and I mentioned that it sounded similar to some of the Aboriginal languages of Australia.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And
well, you know that one of the big things in the Bigfoot biz is recording a wood knock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then there is the discussion, well, how do they really make that wood knocking sound with dead punky wood that's all around in the forest, and really not a tree that resonates everywhere. So it makes one wonder, is that an organic sound? Can they replicate what sounds like a wood knock with a tongue pop? Now, I have a friend that can really make a really loud popping sound just by, clicking his tongue. So if you can imagine a 9-foot creature with barrel chest and the cavity, what kind of a sound that they could make if they could really beller one out, so to speak.
You know, I had a friend once. So
you did?
I think it was you that kind of turned me on to the hypothesis that they could be using their hands also to make that wood knocking sound.
Yeah, when I was about 15 years old, and we won't say how long ago that was, because it was really a long time ago, I kind of learned that trick. You know, bored kid, what do? You fiddle around and you figure things out, and I learned how to make a poppy sound by cupping my hands and clapping in front of my mouth to where I can make a really loud popping sound.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I do when I go out into the woods. I don't take an instrument and bang on a tree. I do that popping sound. And I've actually had interchanges in several different locations with something wood knocking or mouth popping back. So that was fun.
I've been there when you've made that sound, and that's loud. It's impressively loud how you get that done.
Yeah, now imagine if you were, again, a 9-foot tall Bigfoot in the size of their hands and doing the same thing. Also, I have heard, and I've learned to mimic something that I've heard in the woods, is a two-tone mouth popping. Maybe I can demonstrate that for you.
Okay.
Did you hear that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I heard a wood knock in one direction and then an answer with that kind of a pop in another direction. So it was like I was between two things that were communicating with one another, both using different methods.
So what's been going on with you and the Olympic Project? Anything going on? Or?
Well, what we've kind of hung our hat on here for a while, and we're still working on that. We've got some DNA that was sent via Dr. Meldrum to Todd Disitel back in New York, who is working on it as we speak. We keep asking for updates, and we keep getting answers. Well, we're working on it, but we haven't got it done. So that's where we are right now. It's things turn slowly in the Bigfoot biz. You just can't get your hopes up for things to happen as fast as you want because, you know, nobody's getting paid doing this. So.
Yeah.
With the exception of the people that we did have a fundraiser, actually it was Dr. Meldrum had a fundraiser to actually pay for the process. So somebody's getting paid, but you know, not us and not the people that are doing the actual testing, but the labs are getting paid.
I would like to try to find out, you know how you can get amateur chemistry sets and telescopes, and why can't we find, you know, amateur DNA? Here's a suggestion. Just send it to, Ancestry.com and see what they let them do it for the $20 and see what comes back.
That'd be interesting.
Well, here's the issue. It's the eDNA is a much deeper search. Precursory DNA. DNA is kind of like saying Xerox. You know, there's lots of different copy machines and lots of different things that will do different things. So it's a generic term, DNA. There's much more to it than just a simple run it to the lab and have them bring back the information. There's many different types of searches. Now, the eDNA is actually a collection of molecules that are in the dirt, and so it's stuff that has filtered down through time and got into the dirt, and so they pick out the DNA that's collected in the dirt, and you know there's going to be lots of different things in there. There's going to be bear, there's going to be raccoon, there's going to be cougar, there's going to be coyote, and so they got to filter through all of that to see if there's anything of interest. So it's way more complicated than that little layman explanation of what's going on. But I can tell you that it's a much deeper search than just sending it to Ancestry.com.
Oh. Has there, I haven't heard much of sightings going on. Are there still consistent Sasquatch sightings happening?
Periodically, people sending us information, but I think the largest known database and most referred to is probably the BFRO database, and they are getting consistently reports all the time.
Yeah.
So they only publish a very small portion of what the people send to them, because they go through the process of sending out an investigator to get more information. So it's dependent upon an investigator to publish a report. So a lot of reports go into the database that just don't make it to the public viewing.
Any scheduled outings?
We've decided as the Olympic Project this year that we're going to curtail expeditions until we can get out and start doing more field work.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we found is that there's very little time in the Bigfoot business to do Bigfooting and family and or work. So this is, you know, it's still a hobby scenario. I was thinking about that today. Gosh, if we had $5 million budget, what could we do with that for a year?
Now, what could you do with that?
You could hire lots and lots of different people to do lots of different things. I think you could take an area and really research it well. And by well, I mean boots on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
This is a boots on the ground scenario that we're in now. And so it's going to take a lot of people flooding an area to gather information properly. You may be able to get people looking for grants for, you know, college kids that are looking for grant money to help and assist.
Mm-hmm.
But it would take quite a bit. So here we are, stuck with amateurs doing as much work as you can with very little time.
More money.
And spending your own money. So it's no mystery that this is a kind of a conflicted biz, because people invest their time and their money. They want their opinions known.
Yeah.
So if you had more money, would you have better surveillance equipment that you could use? Is there something available?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the thermal imaging would be very important. I would canvas an area with audio recording. And if you think about it, the audio recording should help you narrow down your area of search, and you can with a recorder capture suspicious sounds within a mile of your location. So it would take, you know, numerous recorders to find out if there's things coming through, if there's a pattern, then you would find out when you want to be there, those kinds of things. But it would take a long time, and it would take a year, because you can't just assume something in an area is going to be consistent in the summer versus in the winter versus in the fall. These creatures move around. They move around quite a bit, and I think that their area is quite large.
If you had enough money, could you access satellite observation with infrared?
The answer to that, Billy, is I don't know. I don't know what the technology is that's available to the public versus what's available to Homeland Security.
Yeah.
That kind of a thing.
Homeland could look right through your roof and see yeah. what you're doing in your house.
Yeah, I don't have that capability or technology, but that would be interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
To the field.
Well, I think, of course, it's hard to tell what's real and what's just X-Files stuff, but...
Yes.
You know, I think that you can actually rent time on satellites, and you can get infrared images of certain areas so that you would actually be able to see if there was any movement in that area. But, of course,
identifying
Sasquatch might be difficult.
Yeah, I would say that it would be a fairly large target, which could be confused with possibly an elk.
Yeah, or bears.
Or bears, yeah.
Yeah.
So I would say that you would have quite a few hits, but being able to make any heads or tails out of what you got, that I don't know.
Do you have like a holy grail area that if you could go anywhere in the world to research Sasquatch, one location that you've always wanted to go to, whether you've been there or you've never been there, where would that spot, that area be?
All around the Olympic Peninsula.
Yeah?
All the drainages, all the waterways are replete with stories and encounters. So it leads me to believe that the waterways are connected, which would make sense, that food travels waterways. And they travel those all the way up into the mountains in different times of the year. So, yeah, the first thing we have to figure out is there a home base? Are some Sasquatches more prevalent to kind of stick around in an area? Or do they move around quite a bit? So we haven't even really figured that part out. I do know from recording in several locations that there seems to be patterns of activity and non-activity. I don't know if you can extrapolate anything useful from that because the sample is so small, but it does appear that they move around. They're not always in the same spot. And that would kind of make sense if they were in the same spot all the time due to their size. I think that the location or the area would show signs of, you know, being used by something,
mm-hmm.
and that's part of the issue is they don't build structures all the time. That's why the nests are so significant, because it's a one-off. We're not saying they're Sasquatch nests, but we can't say that they're bear nests either, and that would be the only other logical thing. Now, I don't know if you know this, but when Dr. Meldrum went and reviewed the nests, he found that there were sticks that were jammed in the ground that were holding the nests in place.
Wow.
Now, yeah, wow, exactly.
Yeah, that's
interesting. Bears wouldn't do that.
Humans wouldn't do that.
Humans wouldn't do that, yeah. This was found in a place where humans just wouldn't go. The only reason that there was a human there that found them in the first place is that they were, this is on private timber company, and they had a cruiser going through to kind of mark out an area, and he was in an area that hadn't been logged in 50 years and was scoping it out for a possible timber cut.
Of course he was.
And that's when he found the nest, and then they actually, the timber company actually came to us, which is amazing in the first place.
Yeah, that is awesome.
You would think that they want to cover that up, but they were really nice about it, and they gave us 5 years to study the area. So we're hoping that something will yield good information from it.
Now, if someone's not familiar with this whole nest thing, can you explain what that is, what that's all about?
In a nutshell, there was some timber. It was a section that was going to be cut, so they were surveying it. And the gentleman that found the nest said that somebody needs to look at these, he told the timber owner, because these don't appear to be bare. And he just couldn't figure it out. So the owner of the timber company knew Derek of the Olympic Project, contacted him and said, we'd like your opinion if you could come out and take a look at this, which he did. And they found, I believe it was around 8 nests on a ridge kind of overlooking a stream, which became kind of apparent after you looked at it that this was, in our terms, or actually one of the people in the Olympic Project who is military, said this looked like a military operation because they had established a perimeter and seemed to be protecting something in the middle. And there was one large nest that had 2 softball-sized rocks that were placed by it. And if you follow Bigfootery, you know that there is a thing that's called rock knocking. And these rocks had obviously been scored. So we were very interested. They were using whatever build these nests, build it in a huckleberry field. And they went around, something went around and manipulated, broke branches and literally twisted them off. No biting was involved in this. You can see by the damage done to the limbs. And then place them in a circular fashion on the forest floor to about a depth of a foot. So if you looked at it, it kind of looked like a giant eagle's nest on the ground. And the only other animal that makes anything like this is a mountain gorilla. Hmm. So we were pretty sure that we were onto something that was very interesting. And so we just kept looking around, and to date, I believe it's up to 21 nests have been found.
Wow.
On subsequent ridges that are in this very small area. So,
is it pretty remote?
Yeah, it's behind a locked gate. It's where people can't go without permission of the timber company itself. They don't allow people to just walk back in there. It is posted to keep out that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose people can go back in there illegally, of course, but not that we could tell.
We're talking with David Ellis, one of the core members of the Olympic Project. We'll have more coming up on Strange Harbor.
You're listening to Strange Harbor, ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor. Be strange.
Welcome to Strange Harbor. If you've had an out-of-the-ordinary experience, then come to strangeharbor.net and let us know what it is.
It's Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird, and on the phone we have Olympic Project Corps member David Ellis.
These nests, I mean, they seem, I mean, to me, they seem like a really unusual thing, not something that you would see from any other creature in the woods. So,
you know what's really curious, Bill?
Yeah.
Is that these seem to be a one-off. And by that, I mean, we don't find evidence of what we have seen anywhere, anytime. So, why? why would they build these nests? There had to have been a specific reason, because we don't find Bigfoot nests. Periodically, once in a while, we'll find some matted things on the forest floor, but not constructed like these were constructed.
Yeah.
And due to the number, there seems to be quite a few that were in the area at one specific time.
What are the similarities between them?
And there's no evidence that they have come back and built more. So they, whatever built these seems to know that they ravaged an area with all these huckleberries and have not come back to that area. My guess is until the growth, regrowth has happened. Because they savaged the area pretty good to build these nests. And that would leave evidence of something being there. I mean, you looked across this, it was probably 1 acre or maybe even more of huckleberries that had been ravaged to build these nests. So that's quite a bit of damage to an area. And so, at least to me, it seems like they're smart enough to not come back and do the same thing.
Now, could they be not coming back because you guys are there now?
No, we're not. That's the other thing, is that we've really done a minimalist thing. I've only been there one time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a core member. But others have been there.
I'm a core member.
Yeah. And I've, Derek and the other guys have been in the area maybe 20 times over the last 3 years.
How long do you think it would take a human to build those nests if a human were to do it?
Well, if I were to do it, it'd take me about 4 weeks.
To do one or to do all of them?
To do one.
Could these nests be Vietnam veterans? You know how some of the veterans, they came back and they were either treated bad, so they just moved out in the woods. Could they have made
them? There's no sign of human, and there would be, even with a Vietnam vet. There would be some sort of sign that human were there.
We would use a human architectural style.
Right.
Yeah, with a roof overhead and all that. So.
Right. These were all in the open. There was no enclosure.
Yeah.
These were just a giant nest that looked exactly like a mountain gorilla's nest.
No, I've never seen a mountain gorilla's nest, so I'm picturing like a bird nest. That's what I'm envisioning.
That's what it looks like, a great big huge bird's nest.
So what are the similarities between these nests? Is there some kind of architectural similarity where there's a kind of a shared knowledge?
I don't know if it's shared knowledge. Again, we don't know why they built them in the first place. But we can tell you that they were constructed, and that was evidenced by Dr. Meldrum finding those stakes that were shoved into the ground that were helped to conform the shape of the nest.
I wonder if there's any past civilizations that have used that stake-driving kind of method in their building, like the Aztecs, or, you know what I mean, Native Americans in their longhouses or whatever. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I don't know. We'd have to find out if... from elders of all the tribes, if they had methods for, you know, making some sort of a makeshift bed in the open. It would be interesting to see if there was any kind of an answer to that.
But human beings generally build shelters rather than nests.
Right, exactly. We want to keep the elements off of us and try to conserve warmth.
Yeah.
But that didn't seem to be issue with these nests, so which leads me to believe that, you know, just kind of curling up in a bundle was enough to keep them happy, and being out in the elements all the time with no source of fire, it probably wouldn't take much to keep them happy, unlike humans. And that's the other thing.
Yeah.
There was no evidence of fire anywhere.
Yeah, we have houses, heaters, and hot tubs, and we're still not happy.
That's right.
Right. The size of the huckleberry branches, the thickness, some of them were so thick that even it would take all your strength just to bend them. You know, when a huckleberry is on a live branch, it you fold it over, it bends. It doesn't mm-hmm. necessarily break.
Right.
But these were all snapped and pulled apart. So there was tremendous strength.
Wow.
To make these. So, I mean, the list of things that you can go on that would lead you to believe, well, this is really strange. And it just keeps getting stranger and stranger. It doesn't get any less strange or easier to explain. So, I mean, we've had bear biologists, several of them, look at that, and both of them say, this ain't no bear.
Hmm.
So
it can only be humans or Sasquatch?
I suppose.
But it's clearly not a natural phenomenon.
No, and that's the most important thing. Again, it's a one-off. We don't find these nests anywhere. So far as we know, and I'm talking about numbers. I mean, you might find a nest, like I said, a matted thing on the forest floor. Many of those have been found, but not 8 in one location on a ridge that appear to be establishing a perimeter, protecting something on the inside. I mean, it's fairly obvious that whatever was going to come in from one side, they had an escape plan for the other side. They could easily get in and out of this area because they knew something was coming. And you would never know that they were there. Like I said, they found 8 nests, and there was a ring of nests on the outside and then an inner ring of nests.
How far apart are the rings?
I would say probably, if I was to say that it was a complete circle, maybe 120 feet to 150 feet, the outside ring. And then inside ring, maybe 5 or 6 feet apart.
Wow. That's amazing.
It is.
I know. It's perplexing. And it's one of the more fun things that I've been involved with doing Bigfoot research.
Well, you know, when you're talking about them moving in and out of an area and kind of being able to get in and out of there in different ways, I was thinking about the deer. In Ocean Shores, we have a lot of deer. I mean, just everywhere you go, there's deer.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I notice, we have a lot of very heavy brush and overgrowth simply because of the fact that many of these lots out there have never been cleared since 1962 when the city was founded. So the deer can step right into all this heavy brush and vanish in just a second. I mean, you can't see where they went. You can't see how they got in or out. And they basically just become invisible in there.
Yeah.
I mean, Bigfoot could probably do the same thing.
Absolutely. That's what this area was. It was definitely concealed. You would not know it was there until you walked right up on top of the nest.
I wonder why others in the past haven't found them, or have
they?
Well,
like I said, this was done, in my opinion, for a special reason. And one can speculate what that special reason is. Maybe one of the speculations that I came up with was a birthing scenario.
Oh.
Where the clan had to stop and stay in a location while the birthing process took place. And they had to hunker down and be in a spot for a certain amount of time while that happened. So they don't normally build nests, but this called for it because they were going to be there for a while.
Well, it seems to me if they were birthing areas, that if you could kind of get in there and dig around, there might be a lot of DNA evidence in there.
Well, hopefully they stayed there long enough that enough DNA collected in the nests and then through time filtered down through the ground. And that's where the samples, we took core samples from the dirt and that was below the nest. And that's where the DNA would reside.
Was there any other kind of debris, hair,
Yes,
anything?
We collected hair.
Wow.
Interestingly enough, one of the locations in Gray's Harbor that I worked with a witness you're familiar with him. I don't know if we should say his name on the air, but he knows who he is, from Grace Harbor. And we got information from Cindy Dosen about four or five of them from this area that were similar in nature, an unknown hair sample. Well, we had a match with some of the hairs that came out of these nests with what I had collected in Grays Harbor. If you were to put them side by side, look the same. But they are not a deer, a bear, an elk, or any known animal. And Cindy Dosen, you should have her on sometime, and she can go through the process of how she eliminates it and compares it to others. She's got quite a process. I don't know of anybody else in the whole world that looks at hair the way she does. I know Henner Fehrenbach had quite a reputation, but I think Cindy goes even an extra mile on her analysis. So if there's anybody out there that's listening that has hair, contact the Olympic Project, and I can get you in touch with Cindy.
Have you ever had anybody try to, like, to hoax you with hair?
I'm sure there have been, but yeah. I can assure you that Cindy will automatically, she will know if it's human. I even know what some of those markers are. I won't tell you that, but I do know that she knows, and will be able to tell you. That's not Sasquatch, that's human.
Okay. What about hoaxing? You get people that, I don't know if they're bored or they want to test you or they think they're fueling some superstition or, you know, they're fueling something that's not there. Have you ever had people try to hoax you with like tracks?
I think the most interesting and fun hoax attempt was the LB Trackway. South of Eatonville, and I think there's a little town that's called Elby.
Elby.
And there's a reservoir there. I'm not sure the name of it, but somebody had found some impressions and contacted the BFRO, which in turn ended up contacting a lot of different people because they were fairly large size, and there was over 100 of them. But we, after doing a ton of casting and conferring with all of the people, we started to note that the foot really never changed. So it was always the same shape, no matter what the medium was. And from experience of track casting, I can tell you that each step is a little bit different than the one that you were just looking at because the medium changes.
Yeah.
And when the medium changes, your foot changes. There's a whole bunch of things that happen. So what we came to the conclusion was that this was an elaborate hoax. And so I'm sure that the intention was to get up the food chain large enough. I know that Cliff Berkman was involved. He looked at them. Information got to Dr. Meldrum, and those were the big fish. That's who they were after. They were hoping that we would confirm that these are real and send them to Dr. Meldrum, and he would go, yeah, they're real. And that just didn't happen because we were patient, and we all looked at the evidence properly.
So do you think their motivation was to debunk what you're saying about Bigfoot so that they could say, yeah, these guys said this was all real, but we made it up.
Yeah, they were. It was an elaborate attempt to get the big fish for sure.
Yeah.
And the big fish, I mean, by people that have made a fairly well name for themselves in the Bigfooting community, and the kingfish on that would be Dr. Meldrum because of his expertise in foot morphology.
Not necessarily Bigfoot foot morphology, but just foot.
Jeff has actually created a morphology on foot mechanics itself, and not specifically stating who is the owner of the foot, but the mechanics of the foot. And so he's made a name for himself on that. he just doesn't know what to attach it to because it's not known. But there's definitely something out there that walks in a different way because the mechanics of the foot work differently than our foot.
Wow, that's deep.
It is. It's fun.
So what kind of hobbies do you have? Does, you know, a core member of the Olympic Project have? What kind of books do you read? TV shows do you watch?
Oh, anything regarding mysterious stuff, anything regarding history. I'm a fan of people that have gone before me, so I try to look and always in search of more knowledge. I think that the Bigfoot thing has kind of consumed all of my spare time that I have,
mm-hmm.
which is good. I enjoy audio recording. I think I've done several shows with you regarding that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my predilection. That's what I am really into because of the methodology is coming into an age where it's a reliable source of information. And by that, I mean, it's somebody can look at it visually now, and we can come to an agreement or disagreement upon what we are seeing. Hearing is the worst way to gain consensus, because everybody hears differently. Some have perfect pitch, some have what's called a tin ear. So, and it's kind of the least reliable method.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one that's most often used. You'll have people that will say, I've recorded a Sasquatch, and they'll put it on YouTube or they'll put it out there, and somebody will say, well, that's a coyote. Well, now we have the ability to look at what a coyote voice print looks like and compare it visually to what was recorded. And if there is a match, you say that's a match. If there's not a match, you say, well, it doesn't appear to be a coyote because it doesn't resonate in the same hertz. It doesn't have the same characteristics. Looks completely different. So at least we have some sort of a basis to disagree with somebody that just carte blanche says, oh, that's a coyote. I've heard them 1,000 times. I know exactly what they sound like. Well, no, you don't.
Now, I've heard theories and statements like Sasquatch can mimic other animals. How do you feel about that?
Well, I've recorded something that mimics people calling their dogs, and it's not just a one-off. I've got numerous recordings of something calling their dogs, including one that tried to call one of my dogs.
Ooh.
That was a... Yeah.
Wow.
What happened was I was in an area that the witness I was working with had been there quite a few times. Terry, my wife, went with us. We were walking along the road, and I've started to hear something in the woods off to my left and stopped, and they continued on down the road. And I could hear something following them, and I was listening with a bionic dish, which amplifies the sound in a known direction, and that's how I picked up that something was walking and following them. So I just stood still and listened and listened and listened, and then finally they figured out I wasn't with them. The dog went with them. The witness I was working with turned around, looked at me, and started doing hand signals like, what the heck is going on? And I was pointing to my ear that I'm hearing something, and he couldn't figure it out. So he walked back, and I told him what was going on. And he went, oh, my gosh. So I walked with him back up to my wife and where the dog was. And the dog was antsy because there was a lot of standing around that had been happening. And she was off leash. And I was, you know, still trying to hear what was going on in the woods, and she was whining and panting and running around. And the witness called her. He said, come here, Kaya. And immediately, from the woods came back, come here, Kaya.
Wow.
It was obviously trying to imitate what the witness had just said,
mm-hmm.
which was blew me away. So I'll let you hear it.
Now, this audio is looped 5 times.
Come here, Kaya. Come here, Kaya. Come here, Kaya. Come here, Kaya.
Well, David Ellis, one more time, the website, how I can contact you and all that stuff?
Yeah, you can get a hold of me at olympicproject.com. There's a contact tab there. Just click that, and you can either file a report or send a message, and I get everything that's sent to us.
And do you have research materials on your website that people can look
at? Yeah, we have a few things that we've done. We haven't really updated in quite a while. We probably need to do that. Again, we're amateurs. We're doing this on our spare time. I spend a tremendous amount of time analyzing sounds from people all over the country, and I'm starting to see some things, and we can get into more depth on this some other time, but there's sounds that are out there that I don't think are mainstream, but I'm getting recorded in all sorts of different places. Kind of touched on the percussive voice, but there are some other vocalizations that I am getting recorded, and I'm creating a library of those sounds.
Well, thanks for being a guest on Strange Harbor today.
Thank you, David.
Well, I hope I didn't bore your audience to tears. So.
What audience?
Oh.
We were listening. Johnny and I were listening.
Yeah,
I'll
we were.
Listen. You'll listen. We got three.
Can we call you back in a couple months?
You can call me back in a couple days.
Oh, cool. Okay. Hey, thanks again, David.
Thank you, David.
Thanks, guys. It was a lot of fun.
You know, David Ellis is always interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got so much information about Bigfoot. And it's real, you know. He's not making this stuff up. And you can just tell by the way that he talks about it, that he's excited about it,
mm-hmm.
and he enjoys it. You know, and like he said, he's an amateur. He doesn't get paid to do this. There's no reason for him to make it up. And he's a scientist, so he believes in proof, evidence.
Yeah,
presenting the evidence.
Not anecdotal evidence or feelings.
No, real hard evidence.
Well, that'll do it for this episode of Strange Harbor. If you'd like to listen to our archived shows or subscribe, all that good stuff, log on to strangeharbor.net. We have a Patreon account, so if you like what you're hearing and you'd like to throw a dollar our way, or, you know, 50 cents, $5, whatever, just hit strangeharbor.net. We got a link to our Patreon account.
You're listening to Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor. Be strange.